Exploraciones, Exploratio, NY, Producio, et cetera, et al. versus Maritimas Mexicanas, SA to CV.
Buenas tardes. My name is Jorge Fowler, also known as George Fowler, and I represent Maritimas Mexicanas Sociedad Anónima de Capital Variable. And I think the question you need to answer in this case is, why are we here in this case where absolutely every single significant fact is Mexican? And there are various avenues, seaways to get back. Subject matter jurisdiction doesn't exist. International comedy, and I want to address that one because I think that's particularly relevant, and form nonconvenience. And I thought that the lower court in the Galveston court erred on all three of those approaches. What is important also to for the court to understand is that as soon as this incident happened, within 60 days, Maritimas Mexicanas, a Mexican company, filed a limitation of liability, just like we would do in Texas or what we would do in Louisiana. The defendants, the police, in this case, Protexa, a very well-known Mexican corporation, they filed what is called a querella, which is a criminal complaint, but a criminal complaint in Mexico allows the recovery of damages. The filing of the querella was very important, and the winning of the querella was very important to them because they needed to prove, in order to break the limitation filed in Mexico under the 1976 convention, they needed to prove almost a criminal intent or recklessness, because it's much different than our limitation. It's a lot easier to break our limitation of liability. So they filed that action, and they failed in that action. They failed. That action was dismissed. They did not properly prove what they needed to prove. So when they saw that development and they realized that there was this very valid limitation, they immediately went shopping. They went shopping for a forum.
Let me ask you, we're familiar generally with the facts. Why don't you educate me a little bit about the Mexican limitation claim? Does a Mexican limitation exist from the standpoint that the plaintiffs would be able to go in there and make claims on the monies? Has it been forfeited for inaction or because claims period have expired? Is the Mexican limitation still available?
The Mexican limitation action is there. It is funded. We have never stopped funding it. At no time did my clients think that this approach here through the Galveston Federal Court was going to work. So that is existing, and they can come into that court and make their claims. They probably revive their querella again.
So your claim, ultimately, what you're asking for is to have this case conditionally dismissed.
Yes, Your Honor. And the conditions are the typical ones that I have, you know. We will not assert a statute of limitations.
Let me ask you.
Yes,
our case law seems to be fairly well established that if the district court looks at all the factors, considers everything, weighs them, that basically he can't abuse his discretion on the form nonconvenience. It would appear that irrespective of how any member of this court would have ruled in the first instance, how do you get around the courts considering the factors in its analysis and saying that he's still within his discretion?
The judge's approach to the form nonconvenience analysis, it was like he really just didn't want to understand it. So I believe
he didn't want to look at it the way you looked at it. But I mean, he did he did take cognizance of the parties and where it happened. He made some mistake, which actually seems inured to your benefit, because he made a statement in there about it being within the territorial jurisdiction of Mexico.
He did say that.
Actually, to the extent that he misunderstood that, that inured to your benefit.
Yeah, but I don't think that was a mistake. It all depends on who you look at it. Uh-huh. I mean, I'm going to ask you to look at it from the point of view of the people of Mexico. Looking at it from their perspective, it is their territorial waters. It is the economic zone. I put a chart on in front of you which shows treaties that we have signed. Both of those treaties have been signed. The UNCLOS treaty on the economic zone was a treaty that was signed but not ratified. But we recognize the economic zone of Mexico as being theirs. And I think that I think this court has absolutely the right and the duty to look at what the judge in Galveston did and decide whether or not the form nonconvenience analysis was abused or not. You have that right. I mean, we put all those quotes about Judge Ellison because he was so unhappy with this case, and he kept saying, let me send it to the Fifth Circuit, let them figure it out, so I'm here. So please figure it out. And I'm going to talk to you about the comedy issue, because I'm really troubled. We have to respect other nations, the judicial acts of other nations. So we have two legal actions pending, which is one filed by the plaintiff, one filed by the defendant. But these two treaties that I referred to, those are also the legislative acts, and we must respect, just like we want them to respect us. And the only caveat...
But I thought you all agreed that Mexican law applies.
Yeah, but I was
so
talking...
Where's the disrespect?
Mexican law applies except the limitation of liability law that Judge in Galveston decided he was not going to apply that. Where's the disrespect? What are we doing here, Your Honor? I'm sorry, in this courtroom, dealing with a case where all the factors are Mexican. Everything is Mexican. I was looking for a case. I said, one case, and maybe we'll hear from opposing counsel. You know, in a Supreme Court case, just dealing with subject matter jurisdiction, I'm going to get off of comedy a minute, but I want to get back to it. In the Canada Malton case, all of the factors were Canadian, except the incident took place in U.S. waters, in Lake Superior. And there, the Supreme Court of the United States said, we can't think of a better case to send back and to refuse to entertain jurisdiction. But on comedy, I mean, ultimately, the issue of comedy is the court
retained... What was the district court decision in that case? It had retained jurisdiction?
I don't know the district
well, that
court.
That makes a difference, does it, if we're going to review for abuse of discretion?
That decision was not abuse of discretion. That was subject matter jurisdiction. That was not an abuse. Canada Malton case was a subject matter jurisdiction case, and the court found we have no subject matter jurisdiction. Probably the most interesting question in this case is not comedy or foreign nonconvenience, but how far does our subject matter jurisdiction go? I mean, do we go into the territorial waters, foreign territorial waters, or not? I think that the answer to that is no in this case, because there are no U.S. citizens to be protected, and that's what you have to do in a comedy analysis. I mean, ultimately, before you continue with a case in the United States, you have to say, you know, in the light of these facts, you have to say, well, we have a U.S. citizen to protect, but in this case, man, there is no U.S. citizen to protect. They're all Mexicans.
Isn't your subject matter jurisdiction argument precluded in this circuit, though, where we've allowed admiralty jurisdiction in extraterritorial waters on numerous occasions in the UAE and in Singapore, et cetera?
Oh, only where there's a U.S. plaintiff. There's got to be a U.S. plaintiff involved. Otherwise, you don't take or U.S. contact. But there is no U.S. contact.
But haven't the courts also said that whether or not there's a plaintiff is not material for the subject matter jurisdiction analysis?
Right. Judge Kent said that.
Not just Judge Kent, but the Third Circuit and some other courts as
that's
well.
That's correct. You're right about that. But I don't agree with that. I don't think that's okay. The right analysis. I mean, I think, first of all, We don't want any country going and saying asserting jurisdiction over our territorial waters, and we don't want to go into territorial waters, other countries going into our territorial waters and vice versa. But there are circumstances, but it's not clear in the law. On subject matter jurisdiction, Your Honor, it is clearly not clear. It looks like if it's in a foreign territorial water, like Victory Carriers, and I agree that what they said there was dicta, in part, but it has to be navigable waters, and it can be in the high seas, but we don't have that in this case. This was the territorial waters of Mexico, the economic zone of Mexico. And I would think, okay, maybe we can take subject matter jurisdiction and ignore international comedy and ignore form nonconvenience, but there must be some reason to do it for the United States. There must be a U.S. citizen implicated, somebody injured a United States. This is about a Mexican oil company against a Mexican company that runs it into the platform. All repairs were made in Mexico.
But isn't that why your comedy arguments, perhaps your better argument than your subject matter jurisdiction in this circuit, because subject matter jurisdiction has already been found in other cases in international waters?
Well, I hate for you to pin me down like that, but I will say one thing. I believe that the international comedy analysis takes us straight back. I believe that the form nonconvenience analysis takes us straight back. Does, Judge. Listen, we have 40 witnesses on the only issue, because liability is not an issue here. Everything is damages, and we need to look at their witnesses, and we've issued 15 letters rogatory to Protexa's subcontractors who fixed the Totonaca, the platform. You know how much a response? We've got zero responses. We're not going to get anything. But anyway, I believe form nonconvenience analysis, I think Judge Kent abused his discretion in connection with form nonconvenience. I think he abused it clearly in international comedy. And I agree with you, the subject matter jurisdiction analysis is very interesting because it's not clear. In other words, I think there's some issues, but in every case, in every single case where they've exercised subject admiralty jurisdiction in a case in the foreign territory of a foreign territorial waters, in those cases, there's been a U.S. Party implicated. So,
that's fine.
If we look at the forum nonconvenience rationale that was used by the judge, would you outline to me or suggest to me, not where you disagree with his weighing, but where you contend that he considered factors that he wasn't supposed to consider, or that he didn't consider factors that he was supposed to consider?
In his form nonconvenience.
Yeah, I'm trying to get away from the weighing. What factors did he consider that he shouldn't have, and what factors are you saying that he, you know, the opposite side, where he considered something he should have, or he didn't consider something that
he didn't consider much on form nonconvenience, because if he had addressed the facts, you know, how in the world are you going to find in that access to witnesses is good in the United States? We've got a 100-mile limit on subpoenaing witnesses, and everybody is over there. No, I can't help you there, Judge, because he didn't do anything on form nonconvenience. I mean, he entered the decision that he felt he wanted to enter for whatever reason he had. He did not do a good, detailed, intellectual analysis of form nonconvenience. And the same thing on international comedy. He said, one of the things he said, well, I don't know that the Mexican law is implicated here. And a few months later, he decided Mexican law was implicated. But he took out the good part for my client, which is the limitation of liability. He also said there wouldn't be any problem enforcing a judgment from the Galveston court in Mexico. Well, for goodness sakes, Mexican lawyers and judges are going to look at this and say, why in the world was this case that was started here, that is pending here, why was it removed to Galveston, and why would we respect that? Also, in light of the fact there's this pending limitation of liability action. So, is there going to be a problem with enforcement of a U.S. judgment in Mexico? Yes. It's just logic what it dictates that. And so, and then the next question, one last thing on comedy. He says that there's no conflict between the laws, but he knew very well that the limitation of liability law of the United States is soft. And the limitation of liability law in Mexico is very hard. It's very hard to break that limitation. And that's why when they didn't do well, I'm sorry, you know, I'm to do.
It's okay. You're using up your time. It's up to you.
When they didn't do well in Mexico, in that case, they decided to go to the Galveston. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Let me see. Ms. Adams.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. My name is Julie Adams, and I'm here with Monica Moore. We are representing the Appalese PMM in this case. And the court has asked some very good and probing questions that deserve.
Yeah, I've got some questions for you, too. Yes, if there was ever a case, if there was ever a case that shouldn't be tried in a United States court, why isn't this case? I mean, you have nothing. No one. The law from Mexico, the people from Mexico, the location in the EZ zone, the problems with understanding the Mexican law, the judges somehow coming up with the idea that it's just as convenient to have the witnesses and discover it here in the United States as it is in Mexico. I mean, this just. If there was ever a case that you say, I don't want it in my court, this is it.
Your Honor,
why should we keep this in Galveston or Houston now, I guess?
Well, perhaps the way to look at this is the context in which Marmex themselves looked at it. Within 3 hours of this incident happening, Marmex's American citizen, who is their general manager, contacted C-Corp in Houston to report the accident, ask for assistance in investigating the accident, and respond to it, because this is a vessel where the person on board was trained by a U.S. captain who had just gotten off 6 weeks prior. 90 days prior, this vessel was under U.S. flag.
So they called somebody that trained them in England, should have been in England?
No, Your Honor, the contacts with the U.S. were very systematic. This company was owned 40% by C-Corp. C-Corp is a Louisiana company. So there is constant contact.
C-Corp is not a party.
C-Corp, you're correct. C-Corp is not a party, but the contacts back to the U.S. were systematic. With regard to the adjuster that was.
I called Lloyd's of London and asked for advice from their insurance. It would have been in London.
Well, when you look at the witnesses that are involved in this case, typically when you have an energy or an offshore matter, what you're going to bring in is an energy loss adjuster. The energy loss adjuster that was brought in 4 days after this accident was Kerry Aiken of CTC in Houston. He went to Mexico with someone from Mr. Fowler's office. Mr. Fowler was retained in this case 5 days after this incident happened. So this bit about we had to retain U.S. lawyers. The U.S. lawyers for Marmex were retained 5 days after the accident. They were on scene. They, in turn, collaborated with one of their international colleagues, Mr. Mello, who appears then later as an expert in this case. He is the one who filed the limitation action in Mexico. This is all being orchestrated, though, out of the U.S. What you've got are companies that are operating in Mexico. They are, however, controlled out of the U.S. When you start looking at the witnesses that we are going to be dealing with once we get to the trial and the damages of this case, we are dealing with witnesses that are, you know, J.F. Moore, who is in Houston, Jake Alford, who is in Louisiana, Kerry Aiken, who is the adjuster in Houston, Michelle Hale is their accountant in Houston, Greg Perkin is their engineer in Houston. The prime contractor is Beacon Maritime in Orange, Texas. All of the contacts keep coming back to Louisiana and Texas. This is a matter that was being handled between Houston and New Orleans.
How about the elision itself and the circumstances of the elision and how it happened and the areas dealing upon liability?
When you look at the issues of liability, as I mentioned, this was a vessel that was turned over 90 days prior from C-Corps to Marmex. They put U.S. captains on board. Prior to the turnover, they were taking Mexican captains and rotating them on C-Corps vessels. One of the American captains stayed on for the specific purpose of training him. The problem is training on the DP system. Because they didn't understand the DP system, the mate engages the autopilot, and he never disengages it. He couldn't figure out how to disengage it, so the vessel rams the platform. The problem is you've got a U.S. captain who ineffectively trained. They're also dealing with a manual prepared by C-Corps on board the vessel. That's the manual they're using. So again, over and over, we keep coming back to U.S. contacts. This case was being adjusted on both sides in Houston, Texas. The lead underwriter for PMM is in Houston, Texas. Everything was occurring in Houston. So the logic of this litigation being filed in Galveston is not out of the question. It made sense to the parties involved because the key players, when we get down to this, as Mr. Fowler said, this isn't an issue of liability at all. It's just a question of damages. So when you have both adjusters sitting in Houston who have fully adjusted the claim in English, not in Spanish, and by the way, with regard to all these documents that they're saying need to be translated, this case was only bifurcated 1 week prior to trial. So everything was done. All the exhibits had already been exchanged. So there's no more translation to be done. Everything is essentially done. We tried the liability phase of the case. All we have left are the damage phase of the case. And the witnesses have been identified, the exhibits have been marked. So to go back now and undo everything that has been done would be a huge waste of judicial resources at this point.
What about opposing counsel's arguments about the unavailability of the witnesses via the letters rogatory?
The letters rogatory were sent out 1 month prior to the discovery cutoff. Now, mind you, this is a case that was set for trial 4 times. So here we are years after the case had been filed, and the documentation from the adjusters with identification of every single expense to the penny had been provided to them even before they answered the lawsuit. They sat on it for 2 years. And then decide at the last minute when they have filed a motion for reconsideration that this would help them in their motion for reconsideration to send out the letters rogatory.
Now, well, let me ask you then, at the time that Judge Kent, though, ruled on this,
mm-hmm.
they did not present to Judge Kent any problems with letters rogatory.
They did not.
Being able to get testimony from
them. Absolutely, they did not. And a lot of the things Mr. Fowler is bringing up are problems that he brought up later. They were never presented to the court. The issue of can you enforce...
We do not have before us the question of the second judge declining to revisit the issue. We only have Judge Kent's ruling. That's correct.
Well,
we don't have before us...
It's unclear because they argue both sides of it. And to be honest, it was never clear exactly what they were appealing from. They raised issues as to jurisdiction, which was reviewed by both Judge Kent and Judge Ellison. Form nonconvenience, which was reviewed by both Judge Kent and Judge Ellison. And while Judge Ellison mentioned that
isn't it relevant that certain of the things that were brought to the attention of Judge Ellison, whether we can consider that, in other words, whether we're looking at Judge Kent's decision at that point in time, or is this broader? Has the motion to reconsider now wedged in or made factor those things that were brought up to Judge Ellison?
I believe they do. This case was not appealed until we tried the underlying case. We tried liability.
You already tried liability.
We tried the liability case, and the findings of fact and conclusions of law from Judge Ellison indicated there were two issues for the Fifth Circuit to look at. One was jurisdiction. Was jurisdiction excluded to territorial waters of foreign countries? And the second issue was whether the trial court correctly applied Mexican law. Well, we did not appeal Judge Ellison's application of Mexican law. And the only issue of Mexican law that is before this court now is whether or not limitation of liability, Mexican limitation of liability, is substantive or procedural. And the overwhelming cases that we have reviewed on this are that it is procedural over and over again. It's procedural. The right comes out of the Mexican Civil Code. It is limited by the Limitation of Liability Act, but that doesn't confer a cause of action. So it's not substantive. It is only procedural.
So everything's been done, is what you're saying. The only question is the amounts.
At this point, the only thing we need to do is put on witnesses as to the amounts incurred, whether they were reasonable, and cross-examine those witnesses and put on their experts.
And where are those experts going to be from?
They're all in Houston. Every single one of them is in Houston. The only foreign witness that will come in for the trial on damages will be two witnesses from the appellee, one who is the accountant who kept the records and who put together a very nice summary that has already been produced, and the other who can speak to the operational issues to confirm that they were incurred.
And this is reflected in the information that you have before Judge Ellison.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. He decided to bifurcate the case, I believe, on April 29th, and we went to trial on May 4 and 5. So
now,
just a few days later.
Judge Ellison has some statement where he says if he had to do it over again or that maybe he wouldn't have made this decision or something along that line. I took it as perhaps a statement that maybe Judge Kent was incorrect, but he wasn't going to disturb it. But the way you're painting it now, it maybe he was saying, you know, if it had been back then, I may have done a different thing. But now, in the light of everything that's happened, we've had the liability portion and all these witnesses, that's all we have left, so there's no, I won't revisit it now.
Well, the full quote from Judge Ellison's order, and it was order on a motion for reconsideration of the forum nonconvenience determination, and he indicated that perhaps if he had been sitting in Judge Kent's shoes at the time that decision was made, 18 months prior, that he might have made a different decision. However, given all the evidence that had been developed during the interim, he was comfortable with that decision, and that the overwhelming U.S. contacts indicated that it was an appropriate decision. So Judge Ellison didn't have an issue with the forum nonconvenience determination, and he did review it, and he did, you know, he refused to change that determination. He refused to change the comedy determination. He refused to change the application, how Mexican law was to be applied, that Mexican substantive law would be applied, which, by the way, was on defendant's motion to apply Mexican law after they filed the motion to dismiss for forum nonconvenience. So after the court is considering forum nonconvenience, they decide, oh, yeah, perhaps we should tell the court that maybe Mexican law applies, because the pleadings at that time were under U.S. law. So that determination that Mexican law would apply comes after the determination on forum nonconvenience. And Judge Kent finds that given the factors that he thought it was appropriate to apply Mexican law, but he also found after he had invited both experts to come up, and we had a long hearing where both experts testified, and Judge Kent probably asked a third of the questions to the experts, trying to determine whether or not limitation of liability under Mexican law was substantive or procedural. Judge Ellison repeated that exercise. Judge Ellison also examined these experts. And Judge Ellison also took testimony from these experts. And if you look at the findings of fact and conclusions of law, Judge Ellison went out and on his own did a tremendous amount of research and found other authorities that he used in making the determination of Mexican law and how it would be applied.
Counselor, you said earlier that the procedural or substantive nature of the limitation of liability is somehow before us in this appeal. Do you mean only in the context that it's a factor in evaluating the restatement 403 It's not actually squarely before us as to whether or not it actually applies. It could be taken into account.
Right.
Is that correct? It could be taken into account as we're looking at the factors under Rule 403, whether or not there's a law that's not going to be able to be applied. But we don't actually have to squarely address the limitation of liability, do we, at this stage?
The defendants in their briefs have raised the issue as to whether or not limitation of liability under Mexican law is substantive or procedural. It is the fourth issue that they raise in their brief. It's at the end, and most of that discussion relates to Dr. Mello and Dr. Mello's testimony. Dr. Mello was involved in the convention, and they believe
they claim that it's substantive so that they can get the benefit of the limitations under Mexican law.
Right. And the difference between the two is it's a $400,000 limitation if Mexican limitation of liability applies. It's a $6 million limitation fund if U.S. limitation applies, and our claim is well within the $6 million, so
right,
there would be no limitation issue.
But we're actually where the limitation hasn't been applied yet, where there actually hasn't even been a damages trial. How is that squarely before us interlocutorially at this point? I think it's relevant to the comity analysis but it's not, I don't know that it's teed up for us actually to decide that issue, and that's what my question is.
Because of the determination by Judge Kent that would be the substantive law that would apply, that Mexican law would apply, we believe that the defendants actually had a right of appeal as of probably August, about 2 years ago, and didn't take that right of appeal because they originally filed an appeal to this court, which was untimely. It was only on the forum nonconvenience, and the court determined that there had been no substantive determination, and therefore it was untimely. We go back down to Judge Kent's court. But Judge Kent enters the order with regard to applicable law, and I believe there is actually some authority that indicates that that is a substantive determination. So they could have appealed this a long time ago. We never understood why they didn't appeal it. They kept talking about appealing it, but they never took that appeal. So at this point,
because they have a liability finding, and because they've already have a finding as to the procedural, the finding that it was procedural and not substantive, they have a right to bring that to us at this time. Because I would imagine that this $4 to $6 million thing is relevant from the standpoint that. One law is going to cut it off at four, and one at six. But that these claims are probably going to exceed $6 million.
No, they don't. No, they do not exceed $6 million. This matter would resolve below $6 million. Although I have not calculated with prejudgment interest, we might be reaching those numbers. But
but you're between four and six.
Right.
Okay. So we still it's not a moot thing.
No, it is not moot because the Mexican limitation fund is about $430,000. So there's a substantial difference as between the two. No, it's $400,000. So there is a substantial difference. Mr. Fowler also brought up issues with regard to the limitation and the querela. With regard to the querela is a criminal complaint that is brought. And you present it to the district attorney. It is not a cause of action. The district attorney has the option of investigating it and determining whether or not criminal penalties, not civil penalties. It's not a civil action at all. So there is no civil issue. There is no determination. And if you look at Dr. Mello's description of what the querela is, you will see, we cited in our briefing, that there is no issue in that regard. I see that my time is short. With regard to the issue on citizenship, there was an issue of citizenship that was raised. Citizenship is not relevant when the court is asked to exercise admiralty jurisdiction. That comes out of the Sung Young Kim case versus Frank Mon. With regard to the limitation action, again, if you go back to what Dr. Mello describes the limitation, He indicated in an affidavit, which is in the record at I-1S-644-645, that to constitute a limitation fund does not deprive any person of properties or possessions, nor establishes rights or obligation, and that the only thing that it does is guarantee the existence of an amount set forth in the limitation question.
On the gorilla, though, it's not just like a criminal sanction. It's actually, isn't it moral damages as well, which are similar to civil damages in our system? So it is not just a criminal fine or something. It is moral damages, the same as we would have in civil court.
Should the district attorney determine that he wants to prosecute it, then there could be the opportunity to recover what is essentially a civil penalty, as you describe it, a moral,
that's
basically
what they call
a fine.
It, moral damages.
Right.
But who does that go to?
It could come back to PROTEXA, ultimately. But it's in the district attorney's determination.
It could be like by way of like compensation in a criminal case or to victims.
Exactly. But it is not the civil case. It does not supplant the civil procedure. It is a criminal procedure that is available under the Mexican system.
We have your argument. Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
I'll be brief. I was retained by Underwriters at Lloyd's, and I wanted to say that because I think you understood that my retention has nothing to do with this case. It's not one of the factors that I think it's important. I mean, there's a long recitation of facts, but I urge you to just focus on what are the important
facts.
Let
me ask you a question, Counsel.
Yes.
Can what would other be an inconvenient form become a convenient forum in the light of the fact that you've already had these determinations, you've already had liability determinations, and all we're talking about is a cap. Now, if we're talking about the only thing left in this case is a cap, if we've offended Mexico, we've already offended them, but if that's all that's left, and if it's true, or at least substantial, that the witnesses on this last phase, as to damages, are Americans, why wouldn't that inform us on the forum non-convenience decision at this time?
Because what you just said is not correct. The liability, this is a day and a half for trial. There was an issue of liability. It was foreclosed. The main discussion was they sued TMM, the parent company, and they sued C-Corp, and there was...
Let me get more specific.
Yeah.
Counsel is telling us that with respect to the damages, which is what's left, that the witnesses are basically, in any proceeding that's left to be in the federal court were we not to reverse the decision...
No.
...would
no,
be no. People from Texas.
Absolutely not factual. The 15 letters rogatory are to 15 subcontractors to PROTEXA, who PROTEXA told us we're working for them. We want to know if they were paid by PROTEXA, and we want to know what the reason is for the payment, so we need to explore that. There are six witnesses. This is all in the record. There are six witnesses, including the guy who was in charge of from PROTEXA of all the repairs. He no longer works for PROTEXA. And we said, we need help in accessing him because PROTEXA said, we don't have any control over them. And Judge Kent says, I can't help you with that. So that's just 21 witnesses. But on top of that, we need all, this entire case has not been tried. This is just the issue of liability and the spud cans. The big case now is what are the damages in PROTEXA. And we have to be in Mexico to do this because we will then be able to obtain information. We cannot yet have a judge in Houston issue a subpoena to protect San Mexico. It's just not going to happen. We're not going to be able to have our – for goodness sakes, we have no reason to be in the United States. So why should we be fighting through all this and an abuse? This has been abuse of discretion, and you have, as the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, we've been trying to come up. We tried to come before, you know that.
Well, you're a little late.
Huh?
It wasn't our fault.
But we tried before. We tried before to come up here because this was an abuse of discretion, and this case doesn't belong here. And the big case is yet to come. And it's gonna we have 5,900 documents that we need to translate. I have to bring a translator for every one of these witnesses that are gonna come. So the 20 witnesses that I'm talking about don't even take into account all the witnesses from that work for Protexa that they will bring up here, and they all speak Spanish, they don't speak English. By the way, Jim Moore is a surveyor that was involved in this case, but he's got a Mexico company. By the way, all those insurance companies, all these insurance companies that they mentioned, they have to register to do business in Mexico.
Well, do you dispute that there are any witnesses in Texas or in the United States that would be testifying in this case if it goes on to damages?
Well, I'm not sure, but I don't know of any that comes to mind right now. I can tell you that all the
crew... Council has talked about adjusters and all these people.
I presume that there are some adjusters that are Americans, and I don't know where they live, but I mean, in every...
Council has suggested that there's people that train these captains and whatever, I guess, suggesting to us that they would be...
That may be true. That may be available. By the way, we still have the fight liability in the sense that there's a pending limitation action, whether it's Mexican, Chinese, or U.S. law. We still have to fight that liability picture. So this case has just begun. This is the right time to send it back. Actually, the right time was about 3 years ago. That's when it should have been sent back. I cannot overemphasize that this case does not belong in our courts. There are no real contacts, no real U.S. contacts, Galveston contacts, that would militate in favor of this court keeping this case. And I thank you very much.
I have your argument. Thank you.